Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, can we believe what the experts say? Professor David Miller from Bath University and Spinwatch is here. Plus our weekly news update with Jason Yannakopoulos and next stop on our tour of the universe with Paul Fermi. So we start this week with Professor David Miller from Bath University. He's a professor of sociology. Hi, David, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
First of all, tell us a little bit about sociology as a discipline. What are you supposed to be looking at as a sociologist?
Well, sociologists like to say that they are involved in the queen of social sciences, that is the social science which examines how everything fits together. So it's not just politics, not just geography, not just business or economics, it's how all of that fits together, how the society operates as a whole. And I guess I believe that as well.
So what attracted you to the study of how it all fits together? Is it just because even just one of those disciplines on its own isn't quite enough?
Well, I think that's true, but I think what attracted me was more that when I first came to sociology, I realised that all the things I thought about the world weren't actually mad, that actually other people thought those things too, and that if you studied them enough, you could actually learn more about that and learn how the whole world worked together and how, in fact, much of the disastrous nature of our society had come about. So I came to sociology as a revelation to realise that I wasn't actually mad.
Okay, so the disaster, you're talking about the disastrous parts of our society. Is that what you're looking at? I mean, would sociologists as a whole think of society as a bit of a disaster? Or is it just now?
I think sociologists differ. I think that one can talk about the way in which the disaster of the world influences sociology to become a bit more disastrous. But I think, for me, sociology is about understanding how the world is, and therefore working out how it could be made better. And when I say disastrous, I mean, you know, we live in a world of massive inequality in this country and between nations, which is heading towards an environmental catastrophe. Everyone agrees with that, apart from people who are in the pay of the oil industry. And really, doesn't seem to be any appetite in any political regime in this country or in other countries to actually sort that out. Everyone kind of knows in this country now what the problems are with the world. Most of the institutions in our country are well known to be corrupt, but there's really nothing in terms of any will to try and do something about that, to try and fix the problems that there are in society.
What about universities themselves are rather elite institutions, David, aren't you? How do you manage to fit in? Do you ever find that people at the universities are saying, well, this man, Mr. Miller, is making a bit of a stir here?
Well, that's true. That does happen. But, I mean, I think the thing about universities, whatever the problems that they have, and in particular the rule of money in universities, which has increasingly been the case in the last 20 years, that they do still form some kind of protected space for people to pursue knowledge, and I think that's worth defending.
One of the things that you, I know, helped begin, I think it was when you were up at Strathclyde University, was this organisation Spinwatch. What made you think that that was something that needed doing?
Well, I guess this was started in 2004, and in the period running up to that, I suppose two things made me feel about that. One was the evidence that corporate power was increasing, that corporations were able to run society in a way which they hadn't been able to do before. As we'd seen at the time, the rise of global governance institutions like the World Trade Organization and big protests against that in 1999 in Seattle and then throughout the world. And the second thing which made me think that Spinwatch was important was the run-up to the Iraq War, after 9/11, the huge onslaught of propaganda from the US and UK governments and others to try and convince us of things about the world which weren't true, such as that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and similar products of the fevered imaginings of propagandists. So I think that both of those reasons, for corporate power and the ability of corporations to run societies in the way that they want to, and because governments were able to lie and get away with it, that was why we thought that it was important for us to investigate that those kinds of processes and try and share the knowledge that we found with as many people as possible.
The fevered imaginations of propagandists. Now, that almost links back to something you were saying at the start, David, about, you know, you realised you weren't the only one that was crazy. And I wonder if you think it's true to say that some of the narrative that we're given through the mainstream press, for example, in the run-up to the Iraq War, is actually itself somehow sort of mad, and that it's... maybe you're not the only one that thinks like that, and that there is a sane way of analysing things, which is almost become unacceptable in the mainstream press, and certainly the sort of more acceptable, I don't know if you could call it that, but in the more general dialogues that we have with each other.
Well, I mean, I think to try and tell the truth in the contemporary period is difficult, because there are many institutions which are set up to mislead the public, and actually also mislead the political elite into thinking that X is true or Y is true. So yes, it's difficult to try and find out the truth and to spread the truth, but it is possible.
But, I mean, these lies, I mean, obviously there is somehow money or some kind of financial impetus behind it. But what's the wider effect that has on society? I wonder if maybe it has quite a traumatic effect when people are trying to make sense of the world around them, and they're finding that the things that the jigsaw pieces, if you want, that they're using to put that together are themselves actually never going to help them. And they're almost fighting a losing battle to make sense of the world.
Well, I think you have to look carefully at what the lies are for and who the lies are told to. And I think it's true that in the traditional sense of propaganda, lies are intended to mislead the public. And I think that they do sometimes do that. So I think your point about people finding it very difficult to find out how the world operates anymore and to tell the difference between truth and lies, that is very difficult for people in the world, and it can be very disorientating. And I think that's part of the explanation for the rise of the far right in this country, but that's kind of another question. But I think the other important element we've got to understand about propaganda is not just to convince us, it's to convince elements of the elite. It's to solidify elements of the elite into shared understandings of the world and shared understandings of what's important to be done in the world. And that really doesn't... In that process, it doesn't really matter what we think. So if we don't believe anything that they say, that really is of no consequence to them whatsoever. It only matters to them if we can interfere in their plans. So I think, yes, people are disoriented. Yes, people do sometimes believe the lies. But overwhelmingly, in relation to Iraq, people didn't believe the lies in Iraq, in this country. Even in America, there was quite a lot of scepticism in the population about Iraq. But it didn't require the population to believe the lies in order for us to go to war. And I think that that's the very most important point that shows is that we don't live in a democracy. The notion that popular opinion matters at all to the people in charge is something from a bygone era, when there was such a thing as social democracy, however limited that was.
It almost sounds as if the mass population are kind of bystanders on a one-way communication between powerful people that just want the decision makers to think in a particular way, and we're kind of bystanders on that theatre.
Largely, we are in most circumstances. There are ways in which ordinary people can influence events. They can vote for parties that are largely the same these days. Or they can go out and demonstrate and organise. And that's the only way that really that effective popular action is going to make any difference. But the level of formal politics is not really somewhere where we can intervene very, very effectively, because it's a system which is increasingly devoid of popular inputs, and it's a kind of closed system which we can look at and we can understand if we want, but we can't really take part in.
One of the interesting aspects of SpinWatch, is it spinwatch.org?
Yes.
Is the fact that you when you started that, you also incorporated into it a whole sort of area of investigation. So you weren't prepared to simply just sort of cut and paste information. You would target specific areas of society and go out and find out more about it. Now, how does that all work?
Well, I mean, I don't want to make it sound complicated because it's really not complicated, but it does require you to think through a lot of issues and to find ways of getting information. But most of the information that we get is not information that we get from secret sources or from whistleblowers, although sometimes that does happen, but it's information that we get from largely from the public record or by using legislation, such as the Freedom of Information legislation or the Environmental Information Regulations, which many people, I guess, won't have heard of, or other things like the Data Protection Act. There are many ways for us to find out information, which we can find out as citizens, or as journalists can find them out. So there is a lot of data out there. If you want to investigate an organisation or a set of individuals involved in a think tank or a lobby group, then it's perfectly possible to do that. There are lots of obstacles in your way, but you can find things out on the public record. And the trick is in putting together the scraps of information which are available in the public sphere and putting them together to give a new picture. And that's the kind of thing which we specialised in.
Okay, so can you give us a couple of examples of investigations that Spinwatch has done over the last few years that, you know, you've found particularly enriching, or, you know, something that's that maybe surprising?
Well, I mean, I suppose we have used the Freedom of Information legislation a lot, and that's allowed us to reveal information about lobbyists' access to government, about the fact that, for example, we took one Freedom of Information request about the Association of Ex-MPs, which took us 3 years to get an answer to, by which time several of the MPs had died. And we asked for the names of the people who were members of the Association of Ex-MPs and who therefore had parliamentary passes. And as a result, when we finally got the information, we were able to find out that many of them were actually lobbyists. So this is a secret way for lobbyists to get passes to the House of Commons in order for them to casually bump into the minister or the MP to have a word with them to ply their trade. So that kind of investigation is sometimes time-consuming. This one took 3 years. Sometimes it comes up with nothing, but quite regularly, you know, you can find out information about corporate people meeting with ministers or information which they're sharing internally in Whitehall, which is not being shared externally. And that kind of investigation, while time-consuming, is not difficult to do. And so it's those kinds of activities are really quite important, I think. But then the other way to do things is not even to use legislation, but to check out an organisation by checking out its presence online. So for a couple of examples, we looked at a number of examples of science-like organisations calling themselves institutes. And so we looked up their web address, and then we looked up who was registering their web address. And then on one occasion, we phoned the phone number on the web address after hours, and the phone was picked up by the person on the other end who announced the name of the PR company which ran this organisation. So in a kind of serendipitous thing like that, you're able to just to investigate the things which are on the public record and find out by calling the number that a PR firm is actually running this apparently scientific organisation.
Crikey! So that's an institute which is set up as supposedly a scientific, and you know, by which it sounds like it should be an unbiased organisation, but actually
that's right.
It's a sort of front public relations.
It's a front organisation.
Now, one of the things that annoys me, David, I don't know if it annoys you quite as much, but is the fact that many of these big corporations use public relations, and they use this whole area of putting money into PR to write off against tax. So when they're looking at, oh, there's going to be a big tax bill, they can start spending extra in that budgetary year on public relations, on spin, on advertising, and then they find that they have to pay less tax at the end of the year.
Well, I mean, the funding is another thing which is possible to find out. I mean, many of these organisations, public relations organisations, lobbying organisations, supposedly scientific institutes or shadowy kind of think tanks, they are all funded by either directly by corporations or by large conservative foundations, either in the UK or in the US in many cases.
Conservative foundations. Now, does that mean conservative with a big C, a small C?
I mean,
right wing.
Conservative with a small C, i.e., not Conservative Party, but you know, these are largely foundations set up by phenomenally rich individuals, mostly who've had long careers in business, so in the financial sector or in manufacturing. And they set up foundations to manage public debate and to manage public decision making. So that's what all these think tanks, when you hear of a think tank on television or in the press, they are almost entirely in this country and in the US, almost entirely funded by big business or by the conservative foundations.
Now, one of the things you mentioned at the start again was to do with the oil industry and, and the environment. Can you just drill into that a little bit and explain how that works? Because I think the whole debate about climate change, whether it's really happening, whether mankind is causing it, is a massively important area of public discourse. And policy is being set internationally based on what some of these institutes are coming out. So what have you found out about what the oil industry is up to now?
Well, I mean, I think it's a slightly complicated picture. I mean, the most simple end of it is that the climate sceptics, those people who say that climate change is not happening, or it's not there's nothing we can do about it, or it's not caused by human activities, all those kinds of ideas, those are all people who are funded by the oil industry, more or less, by Exxon or by the Koch brothers, phenomenally wealthy oil industry entrepreneurs in the States. And one should just simply discount everything they say. I know the BBC just the other day has been saying that they must take cognizance of the climate skeptics. Well, they have no basis in any science at all, and they should simply be ignored. But their cacophony, it does shape some elements of the media, and some people do believe the rubbish that they spout. But that's only one element, and that's not necessarily the most important element of corporate involvement in climate politics, because the other element is the kind of liberal end of the oil industry, which says that it believes in sustainable development, which is a nice green sounding phrase, and it wants to improve carbon emissions and probably go towards renewable energy. And they form a whole series of pressure groups, of lobby groups, and they argue that in order to deal with climate change, which they say is happening, we need simply to have market solutions. That is, we don't need to control the corporations. Now, in climate, as with tobacco and other similar issues, the solution is not to try and get people to smoke a little bit less or try and do some nice green things to make people feel better. The solution is to control the corporations, and that's the thing which nobody will say in the mainstream. If you want to sort the world's problems out, you have to control the corporations.
All we hear about really seems to be deregulation right from the banks down.
You hear about deregulation, or you hear about corporate social responsibility, or corporations getting together to do the right thing, to self-regulate, and all these kind of ridiculous phrases, which don't mean anything, of course. They mean that the corporations will be allowed to go on applying tobacco or causing pollution. And in the case of climate change, we move incrementally closer to the edge, and no one will say that actually this is not a solution. You have to actually control what the corporations do, particularly the ones that are engaged in extracting fossil fuels. Otherwise, there is no solution.
A little bit worrying. The other aspect, another aspect of one, I think it's a website too, if I'm right, is Powerbase, which doesn't just look at individual specific people and specific companies, but is starting to look at the wider networks of power. So how does that work?
Well, it's a wiki site like Wikipedia, so you have a page on each corporation or think tank or the directors of those corporations or think tanks, and it tries to show how they are connected to each other. To the extent that they are. I mean, people often think that, you know, there's a corporation which has a certain number of people working in it, and then there's a think tank, and that has maybe some corporate funding, but it's different people working in it. But actually, if you look at the elite of the corporations, the top 1,000 companies in the world, and you look at the big think tanks in any particular country, and then transnational groupings, then the people who are involved in all of those are the same people. They might be directors of 4 or 5 companies. They might also be meet with the directors. They meet in the corporate boards in these policy planning or think tank groups. These are people who are a well-networked corporate elite. And what we wanted to show with the wiki is the way in which those connections exist. It's not just a set of individuals in different companies and corporations. The biggest corporations are actually form a very strong and tight elite network, which is able to take decisions affecting thousands and millions of people's lives every day.
Now, what with more and more privatisation, I mean, we were talking a little while about the health service. It seems that the role of government and the democratic aspects to our society is kind of dissolving. Where does that leave us? I mean, it seems to be taking us down the road where actually these big corporations you were just talking about really do have power. I mean, I imagine, you know, the sort of Bill Gates style characters, people are super rich. They've got so much money. They've got their own private, you know, Spitfire plane to fly around in. They've got, you know, massive amounts of property in all sorts of parts of the world. And when they get to that stage, they start thinking to themselves, well, actually, what I really want is power. It looks to me as if they're starting to get that power as governments in the West are becoming less and less important as more and more of what they do is privatised.
I'm not sure that governments are becoming less important. I think that what has happened is that governments have been captured by the corporations rather than becoming less important. So that when you saw, since the Thatcher government in 79 to 90, and then from 97 with the Blair government and the Brown government, and now the current coalition, I mean, these are all governments who are fundamentally sympathetic towards the corporations, regardless of what they actually say. So that Call Me Dave Cameron will say nice things and say that we have to have transparency, but that's the function of those politicians, is to pretend that they care about popular or populist ideas while at the same time pushing through corporate interests. And that's what all governments in the West, especially the US and UK governments, who are way in advance of even right-wing governments in Germany, for example. I mean, those are governments who are there to push corporate aims. So it's not true, I think, to say that government's less important, although I think it's clearly the case that corporations now have the whip hand and can, you know, change elements of government policy at will sometimes. But there's a whole industry dedicated to making sure that government policy follows the interests of particular corporations. So I think there is some element of competition there between different industry sectors for pushing particular policy options. But in relation to health, I mean, I think you look at the way in which health policy has changed, particularly in England and Wales, not the same in Scotland, where I'm from, which is now where it's devolved and is not nearly as badly corrupted as it is in England and Wales now. And you can see, if you live in Scotland, or you can see that, visibly see the difference between the NHS in England and Wales and the NHS in Scotland. And the way in which that was put in place was by a network of individuals who are from the private healthcare industry, and then they populate lobby groups and think tanks, and they second themselves to Tony Blair's private office or to advisors to David Cameron, and they then move around. So people go from the think tank to the private healthcare industry to work in the Treasury, and so the people who are in the government making the decisions have in many occasions been actually in the private industry themselves. So they don't have any sense that there's a distinction between government and the private sector.
This is the revolving doors, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, we did some work three or four years ago, on the revolving door in relation to the financial industry, and just after the financial crash. We did this in 2009, and we looked at the top 120 odd banks, who are the top banks and the top 1,000 companies in the world, and how many positions they had of directors who had also been involved either in government as government ministers or other roles or in regulatory bodies, and we found a huge revolving door problem in almost all of the banks.
Well, that starts to look, sorry to interrupt you, but it starts to look as if these people are in government, and whilst they're in government, they're being approached by private banks on the outside saying, well, you know, there may be a very nice little job for you when you finish government. Can you fix it for us?
I think it rarely happens as crudely as that, although probably we wouldn't know.
Maybe down the club, the club, you know, one of these London clubs or something.
The London clubs have been very important. I think they're less important now. The big policy planning groups, international policy planning groups, much more important, I think, now than the gentlemen's clubs, which used to be more important. But yes, I mean, I think there's a nod and a wink, isn't there? And, you know, you've seen that in the various lobbying scandals that there have been. I don't know if you remember when Patricia Hewitt and Stephen Byers were filmed covertly, and Jeff Hoon, the ex-defence minister, and buyers talked about being a cab for hire, and these were ministers who were saying, well, you know, we've done our service in the democratic system, and now £5,000 a day for you, and I'll do what you want. And there's very much a sense amongst the political elite now that this is a career. It's not that they've come from a job as a teacher and they'll go back to that job. It's that they're now in a career, political career, when they expect to have, once they come out of Parliament, they expect to have very lucrative careers as business advisors. And that's fundamentally corrupt.
It is. I mean, on the way, so they're seeing really electoral politics as a part of their career on the way to the real career, which is at the top of industry, the top of business or finance. Is there any way to break that?
It's called democracy. And it's a simple idea, but people vote, and that's what decides politics. But the ability of people to vote and therefore to make a difference to the society has been fundamentally undermined in the last 20 to 30 years. Not by accident, but by a deliberate set of processes, but by the very people I've just been talking about, the think tanks, the corporations, and the people who are behind them.
Okay, we'll talk about health, we'll talk about terrorism, and a bit more about finance after some music.
While in the streets of all our fears, they reign supreme as orders go. They are the last to have their say. It doesn't matter how you try, it doesn't matter what you say, they always watch with hollow eyes. To put you down, they always find a way. To criticize, the vultures fly high. They circle over us all, the vultures fly high. I'll take your hand if you.
Renaissance from the album Scheherazade and other stories from the late 1970s or early 1980s. And joining me is David Miller from Bath University, Professor of Sociology, and also one of the founders of spinwatch.org. Now, David, I went down to Froome a few weeks ago, maybe even a couple of months ago, to see a talk that you gave about Islamic terrorism. And one of the things you were doing there was to contrast the reality with what we see in the newspapers and on our TV screens. So can you just explain what the crux is of the difference between the two?
Well, I guess we have been interested in the whole question of Islam and Islamophobia and how that gets encouraged. And so we've been looking at the various ways in which that happens. And I think one of the strands of that is through the state and the information apparatus of government departments. And so we wanted to... Let me tell you the story about the way it came about. I mean, I came across this report, someone online, put it on Facebook or something, I don't know, from Europol, which is the European Policing Agency, which, as I'm sure your listeners will uh, know, is an agency which is made up of contributions from all the European nations, and it gets its data and its funding from the governments of all the European countries. In this case now it's 27 of the European countries. And they produce this report every year on terrorism, and they compile the data from the Home Office in the UK and from the similar offices in all across Europe. And they divide terrorism up into different kinds. They have nationalist terrorism and Islamic terrorism and animal rights extremism, etc. And they have this big table, and they show you how much there is. One of the things I do in my talks is I ask people, I give them the full number of terrorist incidents in each of the years 2008 to 2010. It's around about 500 to 700 incidents every year across the whole of Europe. I ask them what percentage do they think is Islamic terrorism? And usually people say, 50%, 10%, sometimes they go down 2%. And never do they go to the real figure, which is in every single year, less than 1% of terrorist incidents are caused by people who would be described as Islamic terrorists. People are usually quite surprised at that. As I hasten to emphasise to them, this is data from Europol, European Policing Agency, not from me. I didn't make this up. And you just compare that with the way in which terrorism is discussed in the press and the media, and of course, overwhelmingly, the single most covered kind of terrorism in the UK press is Islamic terrorism, followed some way down by terrorism in Northern Ireland. And we did have a slight problem with the data, because there was only one country who'd refused to break down terrorism into the different kinds of terrorism. So, and guess which one that was? It was the UK. And so we thought, how are we going to find out how many of the, I don't know how many it was, 50 or 60 incidents of terrorism in the UK for this particular year were caused by Islamic extremists and how many by others? And we thought, we'll ask the Home Office. They've supplied the data to Europol, so presumably they can tell us. So we asked them under the FOI and the Freedom of Information Act, and they said, don't be silly, we're not going to tell you that. So we thought, is there another way of doing it? So we thought, well, the Police Service in Northern Ireland usually has quite good data. So we FOI'd them, and I asked about terrorist incidents in Northern Ireland, and they came back with a huge slew of statistics about how many dogs had barked in West Belfast on a Saturday night. And we could tell from that overwhelmingly all the terrorism that happened in the UK was in relation to Northern Ireland, with one or two exceptions by Islamists, which are all examples we know about, the Glasgow airport bombing, etc. So what we were able to do, using official data, was to show that there was a systematic imbalance both in people's perceptions and in terms of government encouragement to believe that the single most important threat was Islamic terrorism, which statistically is not. So that was one way through of trying to shed a little bit of light on how things really are, and on the process by which, in particular, government tries to encourage hatred against Muslims. I'm particularly mentioning government as opposed to the press, and I can tell you why if you want.
Yes, well, I'm fascinated, because I would have thought that this is something which the press are deciding, not the government. Surely the press is saying, well, this is an important incident, we need to look at this, rather than the government deciding that.
No, it's the government. I mean, when one's finished talking about the evils of the sun, which I will join you with, or the Telegraph or the Mail or whatever, I'm quite happy to join you in discussing those things. But actually, these stories come from the government. And if you look at, in particular, individual cases, which we did, individual cases of terror threats, and where people were arrested, or, and it was said that there were plots to create ricin or to bomb Edinburgh or cross Channel Ferry or to gas the Tube, any of those things which people might remember from years gone by. And when you looked at that in detail, this wasn't stuff which was made up by the press. It was stuff which had come from MI5 and from the police and from ministers. And so it's absolutely clear that behind all of that is a specific government intent to create the notion of an Islamic threat, which it doesn't really bear close inspection.
Fascinating. What about the link to these experts that we see? I've always been a little bit wary of, when they say a defence expert. I mean, we're starting to get, particularly since the 7/7 bombings in 2005, terrorism experts too. What have you found out about where they're coming from? Because that concerns me, where maybe an expert gets their funding from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the second of what I would see is three main channels through which hatred of Muslims is encouraged, is through the use of expertise. And when we say terrorism experts, of course, we must be very careful what we mean by that, because in many cases, these people aren't experts. Three or four years ago now, we did a study where we looked at the people who were the most highly cited in academic papers on terrorism. And we compiled a list of the most highly cited people, including everyone who'd ever written an article on terrorism ever in the history of the world, right? And actually, the first article on terrorism in the academic journals was from 1973. Anyhow, we compiled that data, and we then compared the list of the top 20 or 30 of those with the list of those who were most highly cited in the English language press throughout the world. And the two lists didn't overlap. So the ones who were regarded as being experts by academics were not the same people who were regarded as being experts by the media. And so that's already a problem. But then you look at in detail at the people who are regarded by the media as being experts, and many of them are just not experts. They've got no qualifications, no academic ability, no academic qualification to allow them to talk about terrorism, and many of them are simply charlatans. We've been involved with a number of those, in fact, in exposing several...
give us an example.
Well, there's a guy called Evan Coleman, for example, who has testified in various terrorism trials in the US and including in the UK, and he was one of the key expert for the prosecution, which sent a guy in Scotland down for an alleged terrorist attack. Several years later he was then released as a wrongful conviction, and he had put together a farrago of nonsense about this guy being connected to Al-Qaeda. He was a young student in Glasgow who had been really angered by Gaza and the attacks on Gaza, and had said some unwise things, but he was not a terrorist. And someone like Coleman was there, and it's been revealed in several terrorism cases and by the work that we did that he claimed to have a postgraduate degree. He didn't have one. He claimed to have his book published by Oxford University Press. It wasn't published by that. He claimed that his work was peer-reviewed. It's not been peer-reviewed. So a series of and not quite accurate accounts of his expertise, but that's one example. But there are many examples like that of people who are simply charlatans. Now that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that the people who are most highly cited in the press, quite a number of them aren't charlatans. They're people who are in real academic jobs, but they tend also to have strong connections with the intelligence agencies or the police or the military, that they tend to say the kinds of things which the police, military, and intelligence services want them to say. And so I would see those kinds of experts as being official experts who are in effect simply mouthpieces for government.
I remember also there was a Newsnight investigation, which I know there was some involvement with Spinwatch, about an organisation called Policy Exchange that said that, this is a couple of years ago, certain radical Islamic bookshops were selling books that actually they weren't, and they went to the trouble of actually falsifying receipts from those. Is something in some way inciting racial hatred, or there must be some sort of reason why people like that should never be able to practice again if they're actually falsifying evidence.
Well,
like that.
I mean, that's the third area of the encouragement of Islamophobia is the think tanks, and the think tanks, of course, funded by conservative foundations, quite often with links to Israel, as in the case of Policy Exchange and the Centre for Social Cohesion, another one which we examined. Those think tanks are there to encourage the idea that there is an Islamic threat, that Muslims are trying to take over our country or outbreed us or some such rubbish. And yes, in that case, the Policy Exchange tried to show that mosques up and down the country were peddling what they called hate literature. But it was shown by the BBC that some of the receipts had been fabricated. Some of them had been written on top of others, which had allegedly been got from mosques miles apart. And the Policy Exchange threatened to sue the BBC, but a writ was not forthcoming, as they say in legal parlance, which means, of course, that they had to take the report down from their website. So those kinds of think tanks are very strongly involved in what they would see as political warfare, and they have a model of political warfare which is based on the Cold War, and so on combating the Soviet Union, and so they see Muslims and Islam as being the next big threat after communism, and that it has to be combated, not It's not a question of being combated in relation to the threat posed by violence, but the threat they see is a threat of ideas, and therefore they want to encourage the idea that Islam is a threat, and that what that does in the end is encourages people like the English Defence League, I'm afraid.
What about health? Because at the moment there's a lot of people concerned about what's going on with the National Health Service, maybe around the world seen as one of the jewels in the crown of Britain, which is now the vultures are circling around looking at it, wondering, if we can actually crush this little National Health Service, people will have to come to us and hand over large amounts of their personal wealth in order to safeguard their health.
Well, it's not just the vultures are circling, they're already picking at the flesh. I mean, the corporations are already in there. And the process by which that happened, was a process in which think tanks and lobby groups were able to populate the information environment around elites and to convince them that there was a variety of views in favour of what they call reform of the health service. Everyone else calls, of course, privatisation, but they say it's not privatisation, it's simply reform. Of course, it is about bringing the corporations in and allowing people to make profits out of the health service, which of course mean that the free at the point of use health service that we knew will be, already is, gone in England and Wales. That's an ongoing process which has been accomplished by private healthcare companies, by the think tanks that they employ and the lobby groups associated with them, and also by their capture of politicians and policymakers, in particular from the past Labour government, but also from the current coalition cabinet, many of whom have got personal financial interests in the health service, in healthcare companies, sorry.
You were talking about political warfare earlier on. How does the public fight back against something like that in order to preserve what actually means, passing down something very, very valuable to future generations?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I think that we are in a position now where the bulk of the population in this country is very, very sceptical about almost every political institution in this country, about politicians, House of Lords, the MPs, the ministers. They're sceptical about the media after Leveson. They're sceptical about the police after Leveson and Hillsborough. They're sceptical of almost every political institution, including, of course, the bankers. How could I forget the bankers? What happens as a result of that? We've had several inquiries in the last few years, including what appear to be quite good inquiries on the press, on Bloody Sunday, on Hillsborough, but we don't seem to have, as a society, any ability to do anything as a result. After the Lords' expenses, Lords' lobbying scandal and the expenses scandal, virtually nothing happened. There's been no proper reform of any of that in terms of transparency or ethics. And so we're in a society where everybody knows that the society is deeply, deeply corrupt, but that there's no ability to do anything because the system of democracy has kind of curdled into something which doesn't function anymore. And that's been done deliberately by the corporations because they don't want it to function. And so that's a difficulty. I think the only way forward to answer the question is for us to recreate the institutions of democracy. And there are many ways to do that. That can be done at community organisation level, or it can be done at a higher level of a popular struggle to bring in democratic reforms. And if we remember, democratic reforms have only been here in the last 100 years or so, and with the winning of the vote, and then the winning of vote for women. That's less than 100 years that we've had the possibility of some kind of democratic process. But those reforms themselves took hundreds of years, took decades to fight for and to win. And I'm afraid that's what we face, a decades-long struggle to try and create a society where some measure of democracy can function.
Well, Professor David Miller from Bath University, sociologist, and also from spinwatch.org, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2, your voice, your choice.
And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos and also Anissa Mirror this week. Hi, you two.
Hello.
Hello.
Jason, you first. Atos, you've got something in private eye about Atos this week. Just remind us who they are.
These are the people who are running disability assessments, as I spoke about
I think on my very first appearance on this show.
Yes, they keep coming up, these guys, don't they? Is it a French company, I think?
They're a French IT company who are doing disability health assessments. That's quite an intriguing one.
Yeah, they've made quite a shift there, haven't they, in expertise. Maybe no expertise. Anyway, carry on.
Yes. Well, they were given awarded a new £184 million assessment contract. And the House of
Not
Lords...
Not another one.
Yep. The House of Lords have raised a few issues about this, being as the last one they failed to fulfil promises made in its tender to run one of four regional contracts to assess the eligibility of hundreds of disabled people for the personal independence payments, a failure that will cause clients extreme difficulties. Now, in the original tender, Atos contractually agreed with 22 NHS and private health subcontractors to provide a network of 740 assessment centres with London, but in reality there are only 8 subcontractors, and neither Atos nor the Department for Work and Pensions are able to say how many of the 740 centres will actually materialise, which means that some people may face journeys of up to 90 minutes, which is half an hour more than Atos promised. They promised a maximum of 60 minutes.
Well, that's a bit naughty, isn't it? It sounds like these contracts are being signed, and then when Atos are breaking the contracts, everyone just forgets about it.
Oh, yes, quite. It also says they claim to have an extensive network of 16 NHS trusts and 2 private hospital chains and 4 psychotherapy providers ready to provide sites for assessments. But after a year, 12 of the trusts and both the private healthcare providers have pulled out, meaning that there's only 4 NHS trusts and 4 psychotherapy providers. Many of the NHS trusts named on the tender have also said they did not actually agree to this.
These Atos people sound rather dodgy. And Anissa, you've got a story this week about This Morning, a TV show.
The host, Holly Willoughby, was interviewing Katie Hopkins, a former contestant on The Apprentice, and her views were basically that she would not let her children associate with other children with working class names.
Okay, so what did she actually say?
She said the words, a name is a shortcut or efficient way of understanding where that child comes from. So in her opinion, if a parent or carer was screaming Tyler at the top of their lungs to obviously get the child's attention in a playground, then that's not good, and his prospects or future prospects are not that good either.
Well, it sounds like this is a bit of an equalities issue here, isn't it? It's like there are under people and people who we speak to and people who we don't speak to based on what their name is. What do you think about this, Anissa?
I think this is really bad. It's basically like a lot of, not all names, but a few names are based on cultural aspects, obviously traditional names or names have been passed down. So to be like, I dislike that particular name and it shouldn't be associated with my child, it's just ridiculous.
Jason?
It's interesting for me because I actually have a degree in linguistics. So, your point is quite an interesting one that comes up, because you look at a name and look at names, say, like Walter, which seems like a really upper-class name. But based on its history and what it actually means, is leader of the army. So it's actually a more powerful name than it sounds. So you get a name like Nicholas, which some people might see as a bit common and actually means victory for the people. So just judging people and their names, it's a different one. It's a really hard one to back up, I'd say.
Yeah, I think you're right. Pigeonholing Anissa, really, this isn't it. What's wrong with that, though?
It's like to say the saying, don't judge a book by its cover, really. So if that child obviously didn't have a choice in that name themselves, so to judge, what, 7-year-old or 8-year-old just running around the fields and saying they're not going to have the greatest future just because of their names is a bit harsh, really.
Well, yeah, very harsh. It says something about daytime TV, that this is a sort of nonsense that they peddle as well. Jason, you wanted to say something about Labour and the unions.
I did. Speaking of names we've got, we have Edward Miliband. Was it Ed Miliband who's come up today, claiming that the unions have too much control over selection for the Labour Party, and forcing members to pay in, and he suggested that maybe this should be reviewed and maybe the forcing people to enter should be gently encouraged. Now, I'm not entirely sure where this leaves Labour, the supposedly the party of the people, of the general working people. It's kind of biting out of the feeds. You or somebody put it on the BBC earlier today. It's kind of, no, sorry, not on BBC. Somebody put it on Facebook earlier today. It's kind of cutting the umbilical cord, if anything, or maybe is that life support? I'm not entirely sure.
That's right. I mean, it's called biting the hand that feeds you, isn't it? I mean, the only thing the Labour Party's really got as any kind of grassroots funding is the unions, and he's saying we don't want that anymore. Well, is Ed mad or is he bad?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, he was branded Red Ed when he came in. I think it's now Blue Labour. So it's
It would be interesting to see if he's actually leading the party into the next election, because I think I noticed Tom Watson's jumped ship, hasn't he? And there are quite a lot of the left of the Labour Party are leaving him high and dry.
Well, yes. I mean, the Labour Party now is quite far away from the party it originally was. I mean. Somebody said, generally true. I've said a lot about what some people in my hometown have said. Somebody said, the thing with the Conservative Party is that we know they're a Nazi bunch of people, but at least we know what we're going to get with them.
Okay. Jason Yannakopoulos and Anissa Mira, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
We're finally there, Paul Fernie. We've managed to get it to the outside of the solar system, to Pluto, but apparently it's not a planet.
This is true, Tony, yes. Pluto, just to cover it in a little bit of brief detail, it was discovered in 1930 and it was logged as the ninth planet in the solar system outside of Neptune's orbit. However, it does have a highly eccentric orbit that's inclined to the plane of the majority of the planets in the solar system.
When you say eccentric, wobbly?
It's sort of more elliptical than circular, if you like. It can be, in terms of distance, it can be anywhere from 30 to 49 astronomical units from the Sun, which is anywhere between 2.7 billion and 4.5 billion miles.
Okay, it's quite a way out.
Yeah, and the reason why it's... was noted it was eccentric was the fact that it actually crosses it within Neptune's orbit on occasions, and up till 1999 was actually nearer the Sun than Neptune.
One of the most recent discoveries, though, is that there's another planet, another body quite close to Pluto, which is somehow is influencing its gravity.
Yes, Charon is classified as a moon of Pluto. However, the masses of the two objects are very similar, leading some to believe that it should be classified as a binary planet system. This is because a bit of physics speak, the barycenter, which is the centre of gravity of the two objects, doesn't lie within either object, so it lies outside of the objects.
So how come it took so long? Is it Charon?
Charon, yeah.
When was that discovered?
That was discovered in 1979, and it was discovered purely by chance. At first, when Pluto was first studied, I think what we have to stress here is how far away this object is and how small it is. It's only 1,481 miles in diameter, compared to the Earth, which is 7,900 miles in diameter. So it's a really small. It's smaller than the Moon, our Moon, and it's a very long way away. So when scientists first looked to study it, they thought it was actually larger because they couldn't actually see the two bodies were separate. They thought they were one body. And then as technology sort of improved in the 60s and 70s, they were finally able to identify this additional body, which is Charon.
So they said that the centre of gravity of these two planets is not inside either one, therefore it's not a planet. But what does make a planet?
What makes a planet?
How do you define it?
According to the IAU, there are three criteria for an object to be a planet. It has to orbit the Sun. It has to have sufficient mass to assume hydrostatic equilibrium, which is basically that it's nearly round in shape. And the one that Pluto falls down on is it has to have cleared the neighbourhood around its orbit. Clearing the neighbourhood is a term basically that says that it becomes a gravitationally dominant body in the orbit. And Pluto hasn't done that because obviously Charon's there. And also there are other objects possibly within the similar orbits to Pluto, because Pluto's part of the Kuiper belt, which is not dissimilar to the asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter. However, it's much larger, and the bodies in it are larger. There was a discovery of a larger body than Pluto, named Eris, and There are several other objects. I believe one of them is called Make.
But we're going to find out quite a bit more about it, aren't we, Pluto, planet or not, when the New Horizons craft gets there. What's that and how long is it going to take?
Yeah, New Horizons craft. It was launched on January the 19th, 2006, and will reach Pluto in 2015, so a couple of years to go. Interestingly, one of the fastest man-made objects to have been launched, had a launch speed of 37,000 miles an hour. It reached Jupiter within 2 to 3 years, and it had a gravitational assist off Jupiter, which increased its speed again by another 8,900 miles an hour. It's currently, as of June 2013, it was out at the orbit of Uranus. And New Horizons has been sent specifically to study Pluto, Charon and the other Kuiper-bound objects.
OK, Paul Fernie, I don't think we're going to be entirely finishing because we're going to talk about the universe or something next week. But
we are indeed.
Anyway, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks very much, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers. Website dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guest, Professor David Miller from Bath University of Sociology, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.